So, Sharath, I have a question. I think I heard till when you know finished your response. I have a question related to what you were saying about the pressures of academia, and which is that, you know, I wanted to ask you about what you see as the pros and cons of environmental scholarship becoming more globalized, in the sense that, you know, one of the reasons why that this pressure to publish in good journals also means that you have to do it within frames that are interesting globally and so on. And I wanted to ask you, you know, what your experience has been in your own work, whether this trying to fit what you're doing into globally interesting frames, both in terms of publishing, but also I think that's also a pressure when it comes to raising funds. I definitely see this being the case in conservation biology, but I'm not so familiar with how it is in environmental scholarship. So I wanted to ask you, you know, what do you see as both the advantages and disadvantages of working within frames that are globally relevant? How useful has it been for you in your work, and where has it been a barrier?
So I guess there is no easy answer, and I do have a bit of a two-part answer to this. Mm-hmm. One is whether we should be even discussing this within this frame of reference of academia.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I personally feel often that getting into the game of journal publishing itself is a problem. Mm-hmm. If you're an applied researcher, your knowledge is for change, then why are you publishing in academic journals at all? And my initial answer used to be, well, it's for to ensure rigor of the work that I do. So if mm-hmm. I come up with an analysis, I feel that I want to meet the rigor standards of rigor applied in academia, which are hopefully higher than, let's say, the standards of evidence or rigor in a consultancy project.
Mm-hmm.
Because so that's the driver of perhaps wanting to publish in an academic journal.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of course looks at the reality of publishing, the pitfalls, the you know the limitations of the peer review process. And then you wonder whether for that reason going into that whole business is really a good idea, whether the game mm-hmm. is worth the candle, whether you need to just set up other mechanisms of peer review, maybe mm-hmm. a friendly circle of equally competent scholars who will openly tell you if something is bad or poorly done, you know, and you can just revise it. So I think that is a question we should be asking also, whether we need to even get into this game and therefore also creating alternative institutional spaces, which is I think SciSaid and then A3 have been attempts to create these different institutional spaces where you will not be measured by your academic publishing record alone, mm-hmm. maybe not by your academic publishing record at all, or you know some variation on that, so that you are measured in different ways and mm-hmm. measured much more in terms of content rather than numbers of papers and mm-hmm. all those kinds of things, but also really measured by what you have put out, which audiences have you reached, you know, and is their contribution salient in mm-hmm. a sense, right? While of course the maintaining the question about rigor,
mm-hmm.
But I think there are different mechanisms for doing this, and one definitely is to create a different institutional space where the standards are different,
mm-hmm.
and so you don't feel, you know, threatened by the fact that everybody else is publishing and I'm this kind of maverick who's not publishing at all.
Right.
In an institute which values only publishing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one part of the story, that we need to question the rules of the game, change the rules of the game
mm-hmm.
By creating new institutional spaces. And the other is that ask the question, why are we publishing? If it is for academic rigor, then are there other ways of ensuring rigor?
Mm-hmm.
At a lower level or whatever, if you said, well, we still have to do some amount of academic publishing, then I do absolutely agree with you that the recent trend towards, so there is a, I think there are again sort of two parts to it, right? In the sense that at some level, when we say academic knowledge, it has to be more than just place specific.
Mm-hmm.
It has to talk about some, at least this is how I'm trained, as maybe it's my training as a scientist, and I'm sure my sort of social anthropology friends will debate with that assumption to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
Is you know, the social constructivist or postmodernist position about there is nothing other than sort of individual place-specific mm-hmm. knowledge. But I continue to believe that there is a certain amount of generalizability that we can bring. And we see the benefits of that generalizability in so many different arenas that I find the postmodernist position a little ridiculous, because the cell phone that I use in Bangalore is the same that I can use in Delhi, and the same that I can use in the US. And all the postmodernist scholars are also carrying cell phones that function independent of the context. So I think it's a bit ridiculous. But nevertheless, I think the question of generalizability being important drives our search for these frameworks, right? Or for work which may be based on evidence from one place, but which speaks to a larger debate. I think the problem is that modern academia is biased. So if you do a case study in Costa Rica, it's publishable, but a case study from Chikmagalur coffee plantations is not publishable. We had that experience with conservation biology ourselves. So there is a bias. It comes from maybe a colonial past. And the other thing is that in the last 10, 20 years, definitely there has been a certain, because of the globalization of academic scholarship, perhaps access to internet, this, that, whatever, certainly access to technologies like remote sensing and GIS, where you know, you can certainly say I'm talking about the whole globe. You know, I've done a water scarcity map for the whole globe. I've done an ecosystem service potential map for the whole globe, blah, blah, blah. These tools give you a false sense of knowing reality, which I think has permeated science and has created this demand for our work must speak to. So as we joke, especially in the environmental sector, that you only get published in Nature and Science if you have maps of the world. some glossy maps of the world. It doesn't really matter whether it's useful, relevant, has any real world value whatsoever, or based upon, you know, what kind of assumptions or data. It doesn't matter, but you need glossy maps of the world as a first requirement. And that is a more specific recent trend. It is a different form of colonialism, because again, who has the capacity to sit and command, you know, 30 centimeter resolution data at whatever 15-day intervals for the whole world? Who has that resource at their command? It is people in the global north. And so this is a new form of colonialism where I can sit in New York or whatever, you know, London, Cambridge, wherever, and tell you what's wrong in your backyard. And I think that's a really disturbing trend. And it's a false sense of sort of globalized knowledge or generalizable knowledge. Because the balance between the particular and general is always something to really be watchful about. To what extent conclusions drawn from, say, the forests of central India are applicable anywhere else in the world. They almost seem, when you go into the context, they almost seem not applicable even in the next district. So how come we are looking for these, you know, fancy trends across the whole world? I think that's a really dangerous thing that we have done in academia, to push the idea of generalizability so far. And so you get this, you know, we did this study of the pollution in the Vrishabhavati River, Priyanka Jambal and myself and a whole team. And we thought we had come up with insights which had never been kind of pointed out before, because it was, again, integrative work. It was cross-disciplinary. We looked at both the heavy metal presence and also sort explanations of why it was there and where it was coming from and so on. And initially, rightly, 3-4 journals just rejected it, saying, oh, it's just a case study. It has no generalized value. So they just desk reject. And that's very common. And the amount of sweat and toil that went in, but also that we felt that it spoke to the whole question of industrial pollution in urbanizing urban rivers, you know, certainly across India, certainly, I would say, across many parts of the of developing countries or the tropical world. But yeah, the journals just say, oh, this is just a case study.
So you say that the direction in which academia is going is dangerous. Is it dangerous also in terms of, I'm trying to understand what you mean by dangerous. Is it dangerous in terms of doing relevant, salient work on the ground, that it will, you know, push you in directions to do work that's more publishable? Is that
absolutely, yeah, absolutely. It's dangerous in that sense that it is, I would say, two steps. One is that it might produce irrelevant work, but secondly, it might actually produce counterproductive work. It is work that is so diverse from reality, but still so biased from by your normative position about, you know, tigers need to be saved or whatever, that you will produce work which says basically, you know, I mean, I'll give you the example of restoration. The whole restoration, you know, it's a big buzzword now.
Yeah.
And so people are going around producing maps of the restoration potential of the globe. And if you ask what's the normative concern that's driving this work, it's basically climate change. It's like, oh, the climate, you know, we are facing a climate disaster, and by hook or crook, by any manner possible, we need to mitigate that by increasing soil carbon, tree carbon, whatever. That is what is called restoration. Today, restoration means increasing carbon on the landscape, right? Forgetting that that is never going to solve the real problem, which is of fossil fuel burning. Because you're sitting in a high carbon footprint society, and you're inured to that, and you're completely blind to that, and you think, and you're scared of what it means to be told that you are at 16 tons per capita per year, and you need to go down to 3 if you are in the US. And you do not want to face up to those consequences. So instead, you go around looking for these global solutions in the form of restoration. Okay, you start with that whole bias. And then you produce these global ecosystem restoration potential maps, which will show that even Bombay has restoration potential, but New York doesn't, for instance. Just because they are so coarse and so shabbily made, with very limited understanding of reality. But they're publishable. Right? And the restoration potential mapping world is like just such a classic example of, A, why are you doing this mapping? Who are you to say there is potential in India? Why are you even interested in the potential India? Well, because then you suddenly say, oh, I'm a global citizen and climate change is a global problem and everybody has a responsibility to mitigate, blah, blah, blah. But no, excuse me, you know, you're living in this country with 16 tons per capita per year of emissions. Why don't you just mitigate in your backyard? Why don't you, you know, demolish all of New York and plant trees over there? Because you grandfather in all of the urbanized world as a given. And so then you're left with, you know, this whole half-earth discussion, half-earth for nature. Yeah, but which half? Obviously not the global north, because it's already gone. So I think it's just amazing to see that restoration debate and see the so-called science that is being published in the name of restoration potential and see how bad the science is. And it's bad not just as in inaccurate, but bad as in it will actually lead to dangerous policies, which will drive out people from their homes, or which will plant trees on agricultural land that is meant for food production and so on.
So Sangeet, Sharad, it's more than an hour. So maybe I'll just end with another question that's related to the globalization of environmental scholarship, and which is to do with funding. So just like the pressure to publish, there's also, of course, constantly the pressure to raise funds. And I was wondering whether what your experience has been. Does that also sort of at times pose a challenge in terms of pushing you into doing work that is fundable, but not necessarily the most salient or relevant on the ground? And also whether that situation has changed over time. I also get the sense that the nature of funding has changed over time, at least in conservation biology. It's gone from being a lot of international funds to more recently, you know, philanthropy and so on, local within India philanthropy. And I was wondering whether that's also the case with, you know, broader environmental scholarship.
Yes, I think the short answer to both questions is yes, that funding does drive what we can do or we think we can do, because I guess we don't have the capacity to do work without funds, in a sense. It's hard, very hard. And donors' fancies, donors' whims, donors' fashions, and donors' politics definitely influences. Within that, obviously there is space to go and look for donors who have more progressive politics and are willing to support that kind of work. They will be the smaller donors, by and large. The bigger donors, like, well, I don't know. I mean, just to give random examples, Ford or MacArthur or something, they also came with a certain politics, but they were also fairly liberal in supporting institutions to do some kind of, you know, different work, slightly more progressive applied kind of work in the environment development kind of arena. Over time, that has changed. You know, and I'm saying now in the particular context of India, certainly it has changed a lot. A lot of the foreign donors have gone away or been driven away actively by the government because they were seen as asking uncomfortable questions about government policy. And what has replaced that funding, if at all, has been, as you said, national level philanthropy, often individual philanthropy, which is much less professional. So one feature of the kind of Ford Foundation or that kind of philanthropy is that the funding comes from somewhere, but then it is disbursed by a set of professionals, you know, who have some subject knowledge, who have some field knowledge. They will actually go and investigate in the field and try to. But a lot of the funding that is happening now by individuals, it's sort of, you know, I made my millions in the IT sector, so I know exactly how to fix the world. And I will then dictate. Or it is CSR money, where the companies are just trying to show they're doing some socially responsible work. But then they love to just see trees on the ground or, you know, benches in the park or school walls being rebuilt or repainted. Nothing really about content or long-term research or anything of that kind. So that's a real a shift in a direction which militates against long-term, rigorous, interdisciplinary, and often socially relevant, and therefore work that raises uncomfortable questions, kind of work. Yeah, it's definitely changed that direction.
With regard to the international funding, are there the same kinds of problems as there are with, you know, publishing, journal publishing, in the sense that in your experience, has there been the push to make your work fit within larger global frameworks, or is that less of a problem when it comes to funding as compared to journal publishing?
No, I think it's there. It's there it's a more differentiated field, because there are donors that are private donors in the international arena, as I said, like Ford or MacArthur or some of the donors in Scandinavia and so on, who are much more, you know, who have their own ideological positions, and they want to support that kind of work, period. Whereas the bilateral donors are heavily driven by, obviously, state policy. So if the US considers India as persona non grata, then that's it, the end of USAID funding in India. If it considers India as okay, but what it wants to push really is, you know, carbon sequestration to alleviate the pressure on the US, that's what they're going to fund. And you see a lot of that. So for a long time, for example, a lot of the bilateral donors were only funding climate adaptation. They didn't want to get into mitigation, because that raises uncomfortable questions about what they're doing back home about mitigation. It's sort of just take climate change as a given, and let's talk about how you can best adapt. You know, so you definitely see bilateral donor funding affected by the domestic, by the political positions of their respective governments. But there was, as I said, this space where other donors could take a different position. So there was a certain amount of differentiation. And the other thing is that over time, that has also changed. I'll give you an example of what I thought was a very good donor, which is IDRC Canada. It was set up as a separate sort of, it's not exactly a think tank. It's a channel for funding research in, so it is an international development research center. It's meant to support research in developing countries on development issues by the Canadian government. So they would get core funding from the Canadian government, and but they had the autonomy to disburse the money for developing research capacities in developing countries. And I think they did some really good work towards that, because they had autonomy and they could pick and choose, and they would try to give institution building support, etc. And they would try to ensure that, you know, it was really capacity building happening in researchers in, you know, the global south. But over time, they have been swamped, you know, their own core funding is gone, and they are swamped. They have become like managers for funding disbursed by bilateral agencies. So then they are just massive amounts of money to be spent somehow and shown as, you know, being useful. So there's been a certain trend in the research funding space where the size of grants has gone up because donors don't want to deal with transaction costs, high transaction costs. They don't want to give 100 grants. They just want to give 5 grants. So you expand the size of the grant, but then you impose all the transaction costs on the recipient. Say that instead of 5 different grants in 5 countries, you guys form a consortium and do the whole thing yourself. So it's all now consortiums that are bidding for these multi-million dollar grants. You know, the work really suffers because there are such high transaction costs. And of course, the hidden agenda behind a lot of bilateral funding and multilateral funding is that half of it should come back to their parent country.
Mm.
So you impose requirements like, you know, you need a collaborator from the parent country. Or you, in the World Bank kind of funded projects, I'm not talking about research so much as implementation,
mm-hmm.
all the consultants must come from the from abroad and be paid $400 a day consultancy to do the work, because you guys are anyway incapable of preparing the project plan. So there's a huge hidden agenda about how the money can, I mean, the UK is a classic example. I mean, at some point, UK funding was considered as reasonably liberal, but the UK university system mm-hmm. is now built upon faculty raising salaries through grants.
Oh.
And DFID's funding is now considered as fungible with research funding. Earlier, it was not the case.
Mm-hmm.
Bilateral aid was aid. You had to spend it in the target country, even mm-hmm. if some of it went came back as consultancies.
Mm-hmm.
But now DFID gives its money to the UK NERC and CERC, so Social and Natural Science Research mm-hmm. Councils. And then they have to look like this funding is going to make an, a development impact.
Hmm.
So they have these, you know, massive projects where they will have work in developing countries, but it's all being done by UK faculty or UK faculty hmm. leading the show and developing country collaborators. It's hmm. a mess. Yeah, it's hmm. a mess. So it's a reflection of politics changing, becoming more conservative in these donor countries.
Hmm.
They don't really want to support international work, but they don't want to look really bad in the international arena, so they come up with these
mm-hmm.
sleights of hand.
mm-hmm. Okay, Sharath, we'll stop here, and
yeah.
I think we can end with one more session. I think, and, yeah, I'll just stop the recording, and we'll continue to chat a couple of minutes.